These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
When you're a caregiver, sometimes sleeping can seem like a luxury, whether it's because your infant needs consoling at 4 a.m. or your teenager is out past curfew, or your partner is always crowding the bed. There are many reasons sleep can be disrupted in daily family life. There are a variety of diagnosable sleep disorders, plus today's work schedules can be all over the map. Electricity and modern technology can keep us up later than we ought to be. So today on the program, we're talking all about sleep. Hear from experts as well as Alaskans both young and old. And we'll end with advice from another installment of our Dr. KTD feature. Stay with us for all that and more. Hello everyone, I'm Shanna Sheehy, host of Kids These Days. Sleeping enough is something Americans, Alaskans included, tend not to get enough of. So what does this mean for all of us, and what does it mean for family life? Do you struggle with getting your kids the rest they need to be their best each day? Do you suffer from insomnia or sleep disruptions when the weather and light changes? Does your child wake regularly from nightmares? Let us know what challenges you're facing. We'll cover a lot of territory today, but the conversation continues all week long on Kids These Days' Facebook page, as well as on our own website. That's kidsthesedays.org. And with me today to talk about sleep, I'd like to welcome two guests to the studio. Dr. Robert Latta is the medical director of the Providence Sleep Disorder Center. He's a board-certified doctor of psychiatry and neurology and sleep medicine. His medical degree comes from Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, and he's originally from Columbus, Ohio, and he's also the father of four. And thanks, Dr. Latta, for being with us today on the show.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
And also we have Karen McBride. For the last 20 years, Karen McBride has worked as a school nurse for the Anchorage School District. About 10 years ago, she participated in the ASD's School Start Times Task Force, and recently was a co-presenter on the topic of sleep at a statewide conference for the Alaska Association for Health, Physical Education, Recreation, and Dance. Karen also is the parent of two adult children whose daughter did well in school despite dealing with sleeping issues. Thank you, Karen, for being with us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, Karen, let's start with maybe finding out some more about this School Start Times Task Force that you were a part of some time ago for the Anchorage School District. What was that all about, and what were some of the things that you all came to and the deliberations that you had?
That was about 10 years ago, and there was a request by the school board that the district look at, explore the question, does it make sense to start high school times later? And so they created a task force and looked at a large variety of issues that would bear on that decision. And that task force ended up developing six possible scenarios of how we might allow high school kids to start later. Everything from switching high school and middle school start times to switching high school and elementary start times, starting everyone just later. So there were six choices that were created. And then the district put that question out to particularly the parents of students. They had a website parents could log on to and give feedback. They held public community forums where they invited people to come, hear about the ideas, and have a discourse. They also mailed letters to parents of kids in school at that time. And the feedback was there was a lot of interest in allowing high school kids to start later. But of the six choices, none of them had a real strong public following. So there was not a real clear direction how to move forward at that point, given that it was kind of all over the board what parents wanted.
So it sounds like there was some consensus that starting later was a good idea, but
yeah,
exactly how to do that, there wasn't one obvious
exactly
choice.
Exactly. Okay. That is what happened.
So is that, and then, so there hasn't been a change, to my understanding,
no,
right, in school start times for high schoolers?
Not in Anchorage.
Has no. There in other parts of the state
well,
that you're aware of?
Interestingly, just this year, the Mat-Su School District has delayed start time for all of their kids K through 12. So we do have a community here in Alaska that is moving forward on trying to make that happen. So Mat-Su has delayed by 15 minutes all of their kids. And they didn't do any juggling around like switching high school and middle school or elementary, just everyone starts 15 minutes later from their or starting time from last school year. And then, if, as I understand it, next school year they will delay another 15 minutes. Oh. So over, you know, the end of this school year, they'll start next year essentially half an hour later across the board. So it'll be very interesting, and I'm sure all the districts and the educators around the state will be looking to MATSU to learn how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do they have the benefits that they hope to see, and how well is that received by the community?
And the idea certainly is still alive. As recently as March, there was a 20-member advisory task force on higher education and career readiness in Alaska that made presentation to the Alaska legislature, where there were lots of suggestions for things that could change in terms of education. But one of those things was to encourage a shift of start time for classes to around 9 a.m. to reflect what the task force called a growing body of evidence of how sleep deprivation and hormonal changes in teens affect their ability to learn and be successful in school. So the issues and the idea is certainly still out there for teenagers, at least, to start them later. Go ahead, Karen.
I don't think it's going to go away, actually. And across the country, we have districts that have changed start times with positive outcomes. Improved attendance, lowered dropout rate, kids reporting they feel better. So I don't think it's going to go away. Plus, the sleep medicine science is, there's no argument but that it makes sense for teenagers to be in school when their brains are more alert and ready to learn. So I think the challenge is finding how to do that in a way that is not disruptive to families and communities and so I think the idea won't go away. We just have to find the right way to move forward with it.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Robert Latta, you are the director of the Providence Sleep Disorder Center. And so you see, I imagine, people of many ages who are struggling with sleeping issues. Maybe tell us a little bit about that age range of people who you see and treat. And since we're talking about teens and start times with school, maybe give us some of your opinion on how that might work for teenagers, say, for school time.
Sure. I currently will see patients anywhere from age 4 or 5 years of age all the way up to late, 90s or so. I've seen some older patients as well. And so the point being is that sleep disruption, sleep problems occur across all ages, from infancy all the way to elderly patients. In specific regard to those folks who are in middle school and high school, the largest group that I'll end up seeing are kids who just cannot fall asleep at all. And so, which is a big problem in those students, especially high school students and middle grade students, where they just can't fall asleep at night, but then they're up late, they physically can't do that, and their sleep onset time may be around, midnight or even 1 a.m., and then they're getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning to prepare for school. And so they're getting shortchanged on both ends of that spectrum. And so that group, specifically those in 7th, 8th grade through high school, are very vulnerable for sleep deprivation. And then when you toss on other things like getting your license for the first time, you'll see a lot of accident issues that start to come into play. There was an interesting study where they looked at two school districts in Virginia. And both school districts had were in the same area as far as the overall traffic flow and commute times and all those type of things, but one group was a 1 hour later start time. And there was a significant difference in the number of accidents that occurred in the morning hours. And that was unrelated to the other commute times and how much traffic there was. And so the point being is you have these young drivers that are out there who have very little hours behind the wheel, are now getting in the car in a sleep-deprived state, and then accidents and things can take place. And so those are just some of the type of problems that students will start to be up against. But when we don't establish times that give them the chance to be successful, then we're just kind of setting them up to have a very difficult morning, day. They're missing out parts of school. Many times they won't wake up until 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, although they're already at school.
So they might have already had like 3 or 4 subjects by then, right?
And you look at their grades, one of the common questions I'll ask the parents and the students is, what are the first 2, 3 classes that you have, and what are your grades in those classes? What are the classes towards the middle half of the day, towards the end? How are you doing in those subjects? And not uncommonly, those morning classes are the ones they do the worst in. And, certainly if there's teachers out there looking at seeing the students, that first and second period, they're struggling to make sure that these students are getting the information that they need. So getting that proper amount of sleep is very conducive to performing properly in school.
And in the case of teenagers, I don't know if it's possible to generalize, but you said that, you know, oftentimes the complaint is that these kids come in, they say, I just can't fall asleep. Is that, you know, is it because of hormones? Is it because of some different circadian rhythm that happens when you're a teenager compared with other times in your life?
Right. There's definitely a change in our circadian rhythm. And when we use the term circadian rhythm, that has to do with our 24-hour sleep-wake cycle that's tied into light and dark. And so the clock, and I always tell patients and parents that our sleep clock is set the moment you open your eyes. And what happens in those students is frequently the brain will pick the latest wake-up time, which may be on those sleep-in times on the weekends. That's, say, 11, 12 o'clock, you know, 12 noon. They open their eyes, the light will hit their retinas, and the retina will essentially tell the brain that this is the wake-up point. So it'll establish a sleep-onset time 16 hours later, which frequently end up being at 2, 3 in the morning. That circadian rhythm is so vital for our ability to initiate sleep. We have massive surges of melatonin that come in. There's a drop in our body temperatures. There's other hormonal changes that prepare the brain and the body to fall asleep. If the student's circadian rhythm is set so their sleep onset time is, say, 1 a.m., their ability to fall asleep at 9, 10, or 11 o'clock is essentially impossible. It would be the same for me if I typically, you know, get pretty drowsy and tired between 10 and 11. I couldn't fall asleep at 6 o'clock. It would just be impossible. I'd lay there wide awake, and that's what the students end up doing, is they lay there awake until they wait for their circadian rhythm to kick in. And students, for reasons we don't fully understand, have a propensity to delay that sleep onset time. And we term that as a delayed sleep phase syndrome. And what that implies is that any kind of light on that tail end of the day pushes that sleep onset time down the road. And we all experience here in Alaska, where as the light increases in the spring and into the summer, everyone falls asleep later here. And it has a lot to do not just with the, you know, the activity that's out there, and we want to get our fishing in and do all those things, but that light pushes that melatonin production farther downstream, so to speak. And then in the winter months, our sleep tends to increase a little bit simply because there's less light in the evening hours, and our brain then picks that time to say, all right, time to produce melatonin, time to drop the body temperature, time to go to sleep. But for students, it tends to delay that. They have a propensity to push that downstream, and there's a lot of things that students end up doing, even now more than it was 20 years ago, that any introduction of light in the evening hours tends to push that downstream. And whether that's television, computers, video games, all those type of things.
A smartphone screen.
Right, all that things. And and you look at the smartphone screens, they're quite bright.
Yeah. And you put them right up to your face.
Exactly, to look at that. So that light is stimulating the retina to indicate to the brain that it is not time to go to sleep. And so that further delays it. So all those things are playing against the student on both ends of their sleep spectrum. So they can't fall asleep. There's a lot of stimulus prior to falling asleep. And then they have to get up early. And now instead of having their 9 hours of sleep, you know, they're down to 6 hours. And that has a tremendous impact on their health.
Tell me about that. I want to know more about what kind of impact that has on a child's health.
Well, first, before you can know what happens when you have sleep deprivation, you have to know what is the purpose of sleep. And our sleep is broken into different, what are called stages of sleep. And our brain essentially exists in three states. We're either awake, we're asleep in a state of non-REM sleep, and then we're in REM sleep. And I say that REM sleep, although it's shrouded in sleep, it has a very specific activity. If you look at the non-REM sleep, and this would be kind of a light sleep and getting into deep sleep, the deep sleep has a very specific purpose. It's our restorative sleep. It's the stage of sleep that when we get into it, we have our growth. There's some nice studies looking at infant growth, and infants will sleep, say, you'll take a one-year-old, for example. You know, their sleep requirement can be anywhere from 12 to 14 to 15 hours a day. But it'll vary. Sometimes it'll vary by 2-3 hours a day. And when you start to really look at that, what's happening during that time, those infants are physically growing. There's measurable growth taking place in those infants. During slow wave sleep or deep sleep, that's when we produce a large amount of growth hormone. that's when, you know, and that only occurs during that time to the degree that you can see that type of growth. So it's very, very specific for growth and restoration. Our REM sleep, although there's still a lot we need to learn about it, it has a lot to do with the neurologic recovery. You figure that through the day, that 16-hour day of wakefulness, we're doing a lot of learning, new activities, new stimuli are being introduced to the brain, and that brain has to make connections. It uses a lot of energy to do that. And once that has taken place for that 16 hours, the brain now has to take that information. It has to produce connections between nerve cells. It also has to replenish each nerve cell with different chemicals that are necessary for the next 16 hours. So it's a very active time. When we shortchange our sleep, then we decrease the total amount of deep sleep that we have. We decrease the total amount of REM sleep that we end up having. And so, for example, if you take a child with, for example, sleep apnea, where there are respiratory events that take place at night that disrupt the sleep and decrease the percentage of deep sleep and REM sleep, frequently those children are smaller in stature. They may be shorter. They're not producing that growth hormone. As kids get older, if they're not getting that sleep, their weight actually may go up. One example I'll give students and parents, if you look, you know, how is sleep deprivation correlating with increased weight? Well, go to any college campus where kids are pulling all-nighters. What do they eat? I mean, you look at the food venues that are around college campuses. They're pizza parlors and they're fast
vending
food.
Vending machines.
Yeah. And there are a lot of carbohydrates, a lot of high-fat foods, because if your energy consumption during sleep is a lot less than when you're awake, and your brain relies on sugars to function. If you're in a sleep-deprived state, your brain is going to demand that for you to function. And so if you're up studying all night, you know, you're not getting some bean soup. You know, you're cranking out some, you know, potato chips and order a pizza in order to continue to function at that level.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, weight starts to go up.
Wow, that's so interesting. I would like to remind everybody that this is Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and today my guests are experts when it comes to sleep and the family unit. Dr. Robert Latta works at Providence Sleep Disorder Center, and Karen McBride is a longtime school nurse. We'll hear more from them, but first, I'd like to share this. Spend any time with new parents, and it won't take more than a few minutes for the topic to turn to sleep. Getting your newborn to sleep and getting enough sleep for yourself is kind of all-consuming for a while. Kids These Days contributor Jessica Cochran spoke with some new parents to find out how things are going in the sleep department.
Carrie Wiedeker. Rosemary is about 5 months.
And so how are you doing with sleep? Are you getting enough sleep?
Not quite. We're close. She can sleep 6 or 7 hours, but just recently she's had a bit of trouble. She's not been going to bed until 9, even 10 o'clock at night, and waking up a lot. So we're not quite sure what's going on.
I am Jamie, and this is my daughter, Chelsea. She's about 7.5 months old. Sleep is going great. She sleeps about 12 hours a night now and naps twice during the day.
I am Marnie Rivera. Miss Chloe is 3.5 months.
And so how's sleep going for you? Are you getting enough sleep?
I am, but it takes me a long time to do, or a longer time. I took some advice that I heard, and that's to stay in bed until I've gotten my 7 or 8 hours. So sometimes it takes 9 or 10 hours to get 7 or 8 hours of sleep.
I'm Kat Davis.
And you have a 7-week-old daughter?
7-week-old daughter, Naomi.
How's sleep going for you guys?
We get patches that are good. She'll sleep like 5 hours, but it takes a lot of work to get her to that point. But then I notice that I wake up even when she doesn't, because I'm listening for every noise. So even when I do sleep, it's not very deeply. I'm still that new mom.
So you're feeling pretty sleep-deprived at this point?
Very tired. Matter of fact, when people ask how I'm doing, that's usually my answer. I feel bone-weary. I'm just tired.
These women didn't wait for me to ask how sleep was going. It was their main topic of conversation before that, too. Napping seemed to be the big issue. Babies who only nap in swings or in cars, or not at all. Dr. Michelle Laufer says sleep questions are the number one concern for parents of newborns.
Brand newborns, and really up through about the age of 4 months, you really cannot impose very easily a sleep schedule on them. Now, some kids, boy, they seem to do the right thing from the beginning. They'll sleep, you know, through the night, wake twice to feed, and those parents have it pretty easy. More commonly, It's not really until 3 or 4 months that a child will develop more of a schedule, that you notice around, you know, a certain time in the evening, they're ready to go to bed. They wake at midnight or one to eat. They may wake at 5 or 6 to eat, and then they're on a daily nap schedule. But if you can start, the earlier you can start noticing your child's natural rhythms, and in as much as your family can work around them, that child's schedule, the easier it will be for you to get more sleep and for your child to get more sleep.
Today's parents have a tool to help them identify those patterns. Naturally, there's an iPhone app for that.
I'm Erica. This is my son Griffin. He's a little over 4 months old. You hit start when they fall asleep and you hit stop when they wake up, and you do it with feedings, how much you've either bottle fed them or start and stop if you're breastfeeding. Same thing, you can mark diaper changes and stuff. So when you're all sleep deprived, you can look back and say, oh, okay, yeah, it's been 3 hours since you've slept, or 3 hours since I've changed your diaper, you know, various things. And so it's really helpful. I don't know, back when people had to do pen and paper, how they did it.
We just didn't keep track. It wasn't that long ago. It's only like a couple years ago.
But the great thing about the app is that it has a graph. It has a couple graphs that show you sleep, when they sleep. And so it's great to help identify sleep patterns and like, okay, yeah, they really are sleeping most of the time through the night, or various things like that, so.
Erica's son used to sleep only an hour or so at a time. Now that a chiropractor has worked out some neck issues, he's sleeping 2.5 to 3 hours at a time. And Erica considers that pretty good, which just goes to show that everyone has a different tolerance level and is comfortable with different methods. As a pediatrician, Dr. Laufer's job is to help families find something that works for them.
Most sleep issues in infants, again, after about 4 months of age, are based on parent training, based on our ability to help the child learn the cues they need to go to sleep. So putting the child to sleep, drowsy but awake, so the child learns to fall asleep on their own. And when the child wakes up at night, we all wake up every 3 or 4 hours from a sleep cycle. So we roll over, and we know that we then roll over and go back to sleep. But if a child is immediately given a warm breast and put into bed with the parent, well, who wouldn't want that? You know, and that is that child is trained to want that, to fall asleep. So we work with parents quite a bit to learn what issues they can control and how that family is comfortable. Now, some families, they have their infant sleep with them, and of course, this isn't recommended, but their child sleeps with them till the child doesn't want to. They may be 8, 10, I mean. And other families, as soon as they can, they want that child in their own room, in their own crib, and sleeping through the night. And that's what's recommended. And really, it allows the whole family to have the best sleep. But, you know, families do things differently. So we work with families to figure out with their family and their beliefs, what is the best way to help that child learn to go to sleep and put themselves back to sleep at night and help the family have more sleep.
It's an enigma. I mean, I've read the books, and, you know, people say different things, and I think, you know, parents need to do what's comfortable for them. To me, it's not comfortable for me to let her sit in a room by herself and cry for 10 minutes, so I've come up with other methods, and she sometimes whimpers on her way to sleep, but, you know, we get her to sleep, and she sleeps on her own. And
Valerie Clemmer, she's about 3.5 months. Kaylee, she is a little different, I think, where she, well, she's proving me wrong right now because she's sleeping, but usually she doesn't sleep that well during the day, and she sleeps all night, and that's been going on for quite some time, ever since I discovered nursing at night, laying on my side with her in the bed. She does sleep with us.
One comforting thought, it does get better, sooner or later. Suzanne Smartjack's new baby is a great sleeper, comparatively. At 6 weeks, she's already slept 7 hours a stretch, at least once. It took Suzanne's older daughter much longer to reach that point.
I think it just took time. Yeah, it took time, and we definitely tried some sleep training and various, you know, tricks to get her to sleep, but I think ultimately it just took a lot of time for her to get to the point where she was going to do it. And now once she's asleep, she's a really good sleeper. She just wants the 15 books beforehand, and, you know.
So you said you tried some sleep training, but you don't really think that's what did it. It was really just...
I think it helped. So we did it when she was, you know, around 6 months, to kind of go to bed independently. And that definitely helped to get her to fall asleep without us rocking her for a half an hour until she was dead in our arms to lay her down. So it definitely helped with that aspect, but it didn't alter the middle of the night wake-ups really at all. And then I think, you know, eventually when she was like 8 or 9 months, she started phasing out of those and outgrew it. So
figuring out when your child is physiologically ready to sleep through the night is something you can talk to your doctor about, because certainly children who need to feed more frequently for any sort of, you know, weight gain or health related issue would need that. But most healthy kids at some point after 4 months are able to sleep through the night. And when we say through the night, we mean somewhere around 6 hours. That's the beginning, you know. Not all, but most kids are able to do that. I know one of my children didn't read that book, and she was not, but two of my kids did.
Jessica Cochran spoke with new parents at Providence Hospital's Cuddlers Group for New Parents, and with Dr. KTD, that's Michelle Laufer, a board-certified pediatrician. Dr. Laufer will be back later in the show to talk about another common sleep issue, nightmares. And I want to make a quick mention here of a concern for new parents while their infants are actually sleeping. The American Academy of Pediatrics recently released an extended set of guidelines for sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS, risk reduction and infant sleeping safety. These additional recommendations include breastfeeding, immunization, and not using bumper pads in the crib. You can find that full report as well as more recommendations on our website at kidsthesedays.org. This is Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and today I'm talking with Dr. Robert Latta and Karen McBride about sleep. And Karen, I'd like to invite you to respond to that piece we just heard by Jessica Cochran.
Well, I had to smile to learn that there was an app for tracking when kids sleep and when they nurse. When my kids were little, I actually did have paper and pencil because it seemed so chaotic and crazy. Like, when is this kid sleeping? When can I count on it? So it's fun that there's actually an app that can help, you know, new moms or dads sort that out. I just really empathize. I remember how hard that was with infants and little kids to get them to sleep and to get sleep for yourself. And so everyone is kind of sleep deprived at that time. But I also think that it was very excellent advice that, and to know, one, to know what is normal. And the doctor said at 4 months, most kids, normal healthy kids, can sleep maybe 6 hours. So just knowing what normal is, what to look forward to, helps you gauge, you know, are we way off the mark? Are we on the mark? And then knowing, too, that if you're way off the mark, that there's help. You know, your pediatrician, your doctor, whoever your healthcare provider is, can help you get back on track so everyone gets sleep, parents included. It's a precious time of life.
Dr. Latta?
Yeah, I think the other aspect of it, I think I can't remember who made the comment, but the production of sleep in infants, it is a learned activity. I mean, it's something that we teach our children. And we haven't paid as much attention to, you know, what is it that we're teaching them? Whereas, you know, we certainly wouldn't let a child just eat whatever they want or watch whatever they want. In the same way, we can't expect them to just inherently know how to sleep. The other part is the frustration that, you know, I had, you know, raising four children, the that early, that first couple years, and where there's such a variability and an unpredictability of it. But I think what we are seeing more and more of is there's so much external stimulus that an infant is, you know, being, you know, I don't know, subjected to, so that they are, you know, if you look at, you know, an infant brain and development, they are responding to external stimulus. And so it takes a lot to process all that information that's coming in. When we overdo it with stimulating an infant, they're going to struggle considerably in the way they sleep, in how they're eating, and how they're behaving. And so, you know, limiting that aspect of it where there's less of a stimulus coming in, you know, a child is only going to be able to pick up a few things, but with, you know, 24/7 and really looking at what you're doing as a parent in what your schedule is like, is also important to then understand what's happening with that infant.
Well, you're listening to Kids These Days on your local listener-supported station. We'd like to welcome new listeners on KDLG Dillingham. We're glad to have you as part of the KTD community. Listeners like you keep this conversation and others going all week long online, on Facebook, and on our website. That's kidsthesedays.org. Listen to archived programs there and share them. Read what our bloggers are talking about and find out what's coming up next on the program. It's all right there. Kids These Days is a production of the Content Producers Guild. This show is made possible in part with help from the Alaska Public Radio Network for distribution and KSKA FM in Anchorage, where we record. There's much more talking about sleep to come in the second half of the show with Karen McBride and Dr. Robert Latta. Stay with us.
Tonight, when the darkness comes, why don't we treat it like a friend? Then we'll both be glad to see the night. We'll be hoping it's never gonna end. So don't be afraid of what the nighttime may bring. You must understand that you can dream of anything. So fall into sleep, peaceful and deep. May this journey help you fly. When you can't hold down much longer, don't you cry. When the darkness is getting stronger, sleep like a child.
Next time on Kids These Days, we take a look at homelessness in Alaska. How many families and young people are officially without a place to call home? What are the reasons for homelessness in our communities, and what supports are out there for families in need? That, and we head to one recent event aimed at raising awareness about this issue. Join us on Kids These Days next time. We're back. This is Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy. I'm speaking with Dr. Robert Latta of the Providence Sleep Disorder Center and school nurse Karen McBride about sleep this hour. I am wondering, Karen, from your perspective as a longtime school nurse, I've read some articles written about studies that can link behavior issues at school to sleep problems or lack of sleep. And in fact, there's one study that says that sleep deprivation can mimic symptoms of ADHD, which is attention deficit hyperactive disorder. And I'm wondering if this is something that you observe in the work that you do, and maybe if you have some perspective of how that may have changed over time or, you know, evolved over time.
I'm not sure how it's evolved over time, to be honest with you, but my observations at school is that definitely we have kids who are not well rested. Sometimes they're in my office and they actually fall asleep, so they present as sleepy kids. They actually fall asleep. But there are kids who are sleep deprived who have increased activity and are kind of, you know, bouncing around or irritable, not making good choices. So certainly that can happen. And that does mimic, it does look like kids who have similar behaviors, who have a diagnosis of ADHD. So I'm not really in a position to parse out sleep-deprived ADHD, but it can look similar. And I've seen kids in my office whom were bouncing around my room, exploring, chatting, wanting to do this and that, and yet they're in my office because they're not feeling well. So sometimes I say, you know, I really want you to lay down and close your eyes. I really want you to do that. And sometimes those kids just flat out fall sound asleep. And so I've seen it, you know, bouncing around hyperactive in my office and given the direction. And sometimes I go over and I actually kind of put a blanket on them, kind of put my hand over their eyes. I want you to close your eyes, 10 minutes. Let's just see what happens. Out. And so then I know that kid needed sleep. Other kids may not fall asleep, and that may be more their personality or character. But there are kids who fall asleep who would not choose to lay down without my active direction and making that happen. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Latta, when you see, say, elementary school kids. We've talked about teenagers quite a bit in the first half. So I'm wondering, when you see younger kids in your practice, what are some of the reasons why they're coming and seeking help from the sleep center?
A lot of the same type of issues. There's been an increased awareness from pediatricians and psychologists and psychiatrists of these kids with ADHD who perhaps are presenting in a little bit of a different fashion. And they are seeking advice for, is there a sleep, an underlying sleep disorder that's present? Mm-hmm. The American Academy of Pediatrics, probably I think about 5 or 6 years ago now, their recommendation is that any child who snores should have some type of an evaluation, or at least a screening to determine whether sleep apnea is playing a role. So mm-hmm. those are the two groups of patients that I'll see most often, kids who are either very hyperactive at school or at home, or children who just can't stay awake because of snoring issues. So those are the two categories.
Do children, as a general rule, are they susceptible and do they suffer from some of the same kinds of sleep disorders that adults do, or are there really different ones that adults tend to get more often and children maybe don't get as often?
The types of disorders are all similar. So sleep disordered breathing or sleep apnea, mm-hmm. it'll occur from infancy to elderly patients. As the population ages, we're seeing more and more sleep apnea occurring. As obesity rates increase, we're seeing more and more sleep apnea in those patients. But there's a large amount of students now with obesity. And so we're seeing a lot more sleep apnea now in those kids. Also, years ago, there was sort of a uniform, kids hit 8, 9 years old and everybody got their tonsils out, for example. Then there was evidence that, that was an unnecessary risk that a lot of kids were going through, and perhaps we were overdoing it. So there was a significant decrease in the amount. If the kids have large tonsils and then there's some snoring and sleep disruption, now those patients are being referred. So we're kind of back towards doing a little more tonsillectomies, but in appropriately selected patients.
Oh, and this would present, the need for a tonsillectomy might present itself as some sleep difficulty,
right.
It sounds
like. Yeah, and kids, again, as Carolyn was pointing out, is that they act a little differently. An adult who has significant sleep deprivation from sleep apnea will more often be falling asleep. And a child, they have a very difficult time maintaining focus. And so in a school environment, what will happen is they may start a task, but then shortly into that task, they have difficulty maintaining that. And we'll see that in adults as well, in addition to sleepiness, where they may start a task on the computer, for example, at work with data collection, and they may go fine for about 10 minutes, and then they have to stop what they're doing and go do something else. And so that attention deficit component is still pretty common in both adults and children, but that falling asleep in class aspect of it is less common with kids with sleep apnea.
How interesting. Well, speaking of falling asleep in class, I know we're talking about smaller kids maybe in this instance, but I'd like to bring our attention back to teenagers. Teenagers are notorious for staying up late and not getting enough sleep. So when the school day requires teens to be in their seats and ready to learn at 7:30 a.m., those late nights can really take a toll. We asked Alaska Teen Media Institute reporter Aviva Hirsch to speak with her classmates about how much sleep they're getting or not getting and how they think it affects them.
Almost every morning, I stay in bed until the last possible moment before heading off to school, which starts way before the sun rises. During the school day, I often feel overwhelmingly tired, but try to hide it. I know falling asleep in class is wrong, but sometimes in a hot classroom, it takes all my effort to keep my eyes open. I decided to interview other high schoolers to find out how they fare.
Can you describe what you feel like at school?
I kind of want to sleep. Sometimes. My grade has definitely paid for it, so I've learned my lesson. Best to flap my arms and stay awake than take a hit on my grades. Usually the class that I'm in, I have to stay seated, so I usually move around a lot. It's kind of distracting to other kids, but I'm just trying to stay awake in class.
So how much sleep do people get per night?
I probably get, I go to bed around 10:30 and I wake up at 6.
Usually 4 hours, but on a light homework load, 5 hours. I know a lot of my friends that will come to school the next day and I stayed up till 1 o'clock doing homework, so I know I'm not the only one who's staying up.
There are times when homework takes priority over sleep. However, there are consequences.
Usually just working on an essay. Yeah, mostly essays. till like, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning, and then I'm dead the next day. I will fall asleep in class, and I can't focus as much. Usually I can't do my math very easily. I can't think very well.
Typically, Anchorage High School classes begin at 7:30.
7:30 is not that bad. I think they should move school up to at least 9 o'clock.
How come?
Oh, so I can sleep more.
School starting at like 8:30 would be nice, because it's just that little extra bit in the morning makes a huge difference.
I don't see teachers giving us homework anytime soon, and school time seems set for the moment. What else can change?
I think the best thing would be to have like a first period like gym. If I had a first period gym, then I'd definitely be more alert in the rest of my classes.
For kids these days, I'm Aviva Hirsch.
Aviva Hirsch works with the Alaska Teen Media Institute. This is Kids These Days, and today we're talking all about sleep. I'm joined in the studio with Dr. Robert Latta and Karen McBride. Tell us what your experiences with sleep and getting your little ones to go to sleep or sharing the covers at night. That's at kidsthesedays.org or find our Facebook page. That was an interesting idea I thought that young man had about starting with a first period gym class to get your heart pumping and get some circulation going. Is it the case? I know I always feel anecdotally that if I exercise, it wakes me up. Is this something that's actually true, Dr. Latta?
Well, you can, and you have a different. You're getting your heart rate up. You're not using your brain in regards to concentrating abilities, and so people can't experience it an improvement. But it doesn't necessarily improve your alertness through the entire rest of the day. There may be a 4 or 5 hour period of time you're more alert. For example, never have anybody who's having sleep difficulty falling asleep to exercise before they're going to bed, because it's a stimulant component. So it does have the validity in doing so. But one of the other things that young man pointed out was that he learned his lesson about not falling asleep. And I don't know if it's necessarily a myth, but it's almost a perception of, you know, that sleep is a personal decision, or that their inability to fall asleep is something that it's a behavior issue, or that falling asleep is something that is that you can control. Mm-hmm. And when you look at this situation where you very shortchanged sleep, the one kid was, you know, 4 or 5 hours a night.
Yeah.
That would be the equivalent, if you really look at as sleep as being just a physiologic thing that we're supposed to be doing, it'd be the equivalent of saying, okay, I'm going to decrease my calorie intake to 500 calories a day for the next 5 days and see what kind of effect it has. And then on the weekends, I'm just going to binge. And that's kind of what this, I'm not going to sleep during the weekday, stay up late, get up early, and then on the weekend sleep until 12 or 1 o'clock. I mean, that's the equivalent of not eating during the week and then just consuming all your calories on the weekend. And you can see what a negative and detrimental effect it'll have on your health. So really...
Just imagine, it's a great analogy, because I'm just thinking it through, and it makes me feel panicked to imagine going 5 days only eating 500 calories a day. Right. Can't even imagine the monster I would be at the end of the week.
Right. I mean, it would be, I mean, I just think about doing it for one day, but yet we've become conditioned and tolerant that sleep is something that is a personal decision. I mean, there's always a lot of bravado and saying how I did not sleep, you know, at night last night, and look what I've done. I've accomplished this. Or you go all the way back to our founding fathers, and, you know, Benjamin Franklin was like, you know, sleep was something equivalent to being lazy. And so it goes back a long way. That to be successful, you don't sleep. But some of the students are noticing that that cascading effect that it has of not sleeping. So, for example, say you stay up all night one night to start a project, and you slept 4 or 5 hours, and then you have to continue that project the next day. If you really time the length of time it's going to take you to accomplish that project, it's a lot longer. So if you have to do an assignment that perhaps takes an hour with good sleep, without good sleep, it's going to take 2 hours, which then perpetuates the whole sleep issue. So as opposed to sleep being the last thing you end up doing, you need to start your day with budgeting time for that. We budget time for students to eat lunch, although that's getting shorter, so they have an entire period to eat their lunch. But we don't budget time for sleep. So if my sleep in a student should be 9 hours, that's where you start to build your schedule for the day. If that's where it comes first, then you'll find that all those things and activities that we need to get done come much easier and much more efficiently and much more accurately as well. So,
well, Karen McBride, you mentioned earlier in the program that parents understanding how much is normal for a child is really important. And I'd like to mention, for example, we found a real easy to read list of what's recommended amounts of sleep per age or by age. And in the case of 12 to 18 year olds, the information that we found was 8 to 9 hours a day. Does that jive with your information,
yes,
Dr. Latta?
Correct.
And then in the case of babies, as we mentioned already on the show too, like 15 to 16 hours a day, 3 to 6 year old, 10 to 12 hours a day. We'll link to this list from our website at kidsthesedays.org so that you as a parent, if you're interested, can look to see where your child falls and what you should be looking at in terms of sleep. And Karen McBride, in the time that we have left, we mentioned in the beginning of the show that you have two adult children and your daughter had some sleep disruption and some problems, but was able to do well in school despite that. And maybe you could tell us how you managed that with your daughter. Maybe, you know, what were her complications and how did you find a way to deal with those?
Well, my daughter ended up being diagnosed with delayed sleep phase syndrome, which is kind of at, you know, one end of the sleep problem spectrum. So more sleep difficulty than your average adolescent kid. And additionally, she also is what they call a long sleeper. Like, she needed 11 hours of sleep to be rested and alert the next day.
As a teenager.
Yeah, you know, most kids, they need about 9. Teenagers need about 9. Mm-hmm. Some get by with maybe 8 or even less, and some need more. And she was on that spectrum that needed more sleep. And she had the delayed sleep onset. So it was very problematic for school. She ended up not being able to attend school for a period of time because she absolutely couldn't be at school for a 7:30-hour class. It just couldn't happen. So what we did is we did a combination of homeschooling and then attending at her local school, her high school, afternoon classes only. And then this all kind of flew up on our faces, the sleep problems her freshman year of high school. So there was a period of non-attendance. But by the time she was a senior, she was back to taking, I think, maybe 4 or 5 classes out of 7. You know, she had not a full day, never did start at 7:30. That was impossible for her. So we married the two together of homeschooling and attending the local school in the afternoon. And she was a very talented, hardworking student, was very devoted to school and pulled that off, graduated on schedule with honors. So she made good use of her time. And homeschooling was a very nice mm-hmm. adjunct for us.
And was it a challenging process to, as a family, figure there's an issue and we need to address this and to, you know, take her in for a diagnosis and this
yes.
kind of thing? Was that a process?
Yeah, and because, you know, one point in fact is I didn't know about basic sleep changes for teenagers. I mean, as a school nurse, I work with elementary kids, and Megan was my oldest child, so it was like my first experience with teen sleep issues, and not all teens have as much difficulty. But I was like, I really didn't know. I didn't know the norms. And so it was a really big learning curve for me, and I partnered with Dr. Morris and did a lot of learning. So then I knew what we were dealing with. At first, we really didn't know what was going on. So learning good information, working with a medical provider who was an expert in that area, mm-hmm. a sleep expert, was essential for us. And then getting good care, and then coming up with a plan that was very successful. The process was hard because the learning curve was steep in front of me. I didn't have as much information as I do now. And I think the show is great for parents of infants, school-age kids, and teenagers because we're introducing and sharing the accurate information you need in order to assess, does my child have enough sleep? Do I have enough sleep?
Yeah.
And one thing I would like to just say as a school nurse, one thing I say to kids and to parents on a regular basis is, if when it's time to wake up in the morning, it's hard to wake up and it's hard to get out of bed, you're just dragging, that's your body telling you, you needed to get to bed earlier. I mean, it's really that simple and concrete. But you have to kind of think that through and know that. So that's one thing I would like to share with parents now is look for those symptoms that your child is sleep deprived and then make changes to turn that around. And a lot of it comes back to beginning that, getting ready for sleep earlier in the evening, you know, turning off the electronics, making the house quiet, the whole house quiet. Lights are kind of dimmed down, particularly if it's summer months. but really notching down the environment so that the brain gets the cues, it's about time to go to sleep. Mm-hmm. And it's not an expensive correction. A lot of parents can turn that around with good information and maybe help with their medical providers, you know, helping them down that road.
Mm-hmm. And Robert, as a medical provider, this is your opportunity this is the last word of the program this hour. And I'm really curious, too, about what are there fixes to this issue? If you, as a parent or a family member or a couple or your children are experiencing just not getting enough sleep or any of these disorders, like what are some of the fixes that are out there that you can share in a general sense?
Sure. I mean, I think the first aspect is identifying, are there problems with sleep? And like Karen mentioned, like if you're having difficulty waking up in the morning, if you're finding that you're pounding some caffeine to get through the day, if you're getting drowsy in the afternoon, sitting down after lunch, if you're noticing that, I can't really finish a chapter reading, or for children, if they're getting more anxious, or they're throwing more temper tantrums, or a lot of times infants they get too tired to fall asleep, that they're crying, and that it's a very good sign of sleep deprivation. Then a good idea is to do a kind of a home assessment. Take a look at what you and your family, because sleep in the household is a household thing. It's not one person just struggling, because that one individual is going to affect everybody else around the house, and everyone else in the house is going to affect that one individual. Mm-hmm. So a good idea is for a week or two is to really get a sense of what are the sleep patterns in our house. When do we turn the TV off? Where are the bedrooms? What time are kids going to sleep? What time are parents going to sleep? When are they getting up? What are the weekends like compared to the weekdays? The more information you can gather is going to be very helpful for the pediatrician or family practice physician or internist, what have you, to take a look and say, okay, well, what's happening with this sleep? Well, here's some patterns that we're starting to see develop. And through that, we can then develop some strategies that the families can then use effectively to turn some things around. But there are a lot of things that can be done, and they don't necessarily entail medications. They don't necessarily entail sleep studies. A lot of folks get turned off by the sleep study aspect of it. I don't want to sleep in a lab and those type of things. But really getting a general sense of what's the real diagnosis here, what's really happening.
It sounds like some deliberate attention to it.
Right.
And then maybe some discipline around it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, excellent. Well, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us today. It's been a really fun conversation. I feel like we could keep going. But unfortunately, that's all the time we have today. Karen McBride is a 20-year career school nurse with the Anchorage School District and a former participant in the School Start Times Task Force with the ASD. Thanks for being here, Karen.
Thank you.
And Dr. Robert Latta is the medical director for the Sleep Disorder Center at Providence Alaska Medical Center in Anchorage. Thanks to you for being here.
It was a lot of fun to be here. Thanks.
And as I mentioned throughout the program, we'll link you to information we've discussed today, like Dr. Latta's clinic, the safe infant sleeping tips mentioned that were just released by the American Academy of Pediatrics, and an article about recent recommendations for later start times for Alaska high schoolers written by the Anchorage Daily News, plus some serious comedy about a serious sleeping problem that we'll link you to as well. Link to that and more from kidsthesedays.org. Now it's time to hear from Dr. KTD again. Michelle Laufer is a board-certified pediatrician who regularly helps our listeners understand and handle common parenting issues from a medical perspective. In this segment, she explains two common sleep issues, night terrors and nightmares.
Night terrors and nightmares are both very common in children, but they are sort of different phenomenon. Night terrors occur early in the evening, generally 45 minutes to a couple of hours after you put the child to sleep. And parents often describe hearing their child scream, writhe around in the bed, yelling, often scary things. Children in night terrors are not awake during this process. They appear very upset, but they are not awake, and they will not remember the episode in the morning. So what parents can do is go in and be with the child But really, the child is not awake, and it is very hard to wake them up, and you shouldn't try and wake them up. They'll go through the process of their night terror in, you know, a few minutes to sometimes, you know, 20 minutes. It can be a long episode. And then the child will fall back asleep, just sort of gradually or suddenly fall back asleep. And in the morning, they won't remember. So there's really no need to bring it up or talk about it. They won't remember in the morning. So nightmares, adults have nightmares as well, so we're all familiar with nightmares. Nightmares occur later in the evening during the dream state. Often children have the nightmare and then wake up and come tell you. You may or may not hear them during the nightmare, but often this is when kids come up and say, oh, I had a nightmare about X or Y. So when they come tell you about it, they're awake and they may want to talk about it. So it's okay to listen and hear what they're saying about what they were afraid of or what happened in their nightmare. And they may also have some difficulty falling back asleep because they are awake and they have some anxiety about going back to sleep and either having that same nightmare or that thing actually happening, the monster or someone chasing them or whatever the nightmare may be. As well, in the morning, the child will, you know, remember the nightmare and that they woke up and that they had a nightmare and they may want to further talk about it. And this is in contrast to the night terror, which a child won't remember and you don't need to bring up or talk about it. They won't recall it. Nightmares, as really an extreme form of a dream, are obviously a natural process. And as long as a child's not having extremely disturbing, you know, disruptive nightmares, it's not a pathologic process. But you can help your child by avoiding media before bed, especially violent media, video games, even television shows that, while it may not seem violent or upsetting to you, even cartoons can evoke things in a child's mind. So be really conscious and aware of what your child is being exposed to, especially in the evening before bed, to avoid nightmares. Night terrors are often brought about by either fever or illness or irregular sleep schedules. So if your child is overtired or you've been traveling and they're not on their normal sleep schedule, this is when we sometimes see an increase in night terrors. So keeping your child on a normal sleep schedule, keeping them from getting overtired, can help kids who have frequent night terrors.
Dr. KTD is Anchorage pediatrician Michelle Laufer. To find more of her advice, head to our website, kidsthesedays.org, and search for Dr. KTD. That's all for this hour of Kids These Days. Thanks again to guests Dr. Robert Latta and Karen McBride. A special hello to our listeners in Unalaska, Talkeetna, Juneau, Prudhoe Bay, and Dillingham. Don't forget you can hear this program again or any of our past shows by simply going to kidsthesedays.org. We had help today from Aviva Hirsch and her mentors at the Alaska Teen Media Institute, a Spirit of Youth program. Michelle Laufer is our Dr. KTD. Jessica Cochran is our regular contributor, assistant producer, and technical editor. Sarah Gonzalez is our producer, business manager, and online content editor. Special thanks to Dave Waldron at Alaska Public Telecommunications for his continuing support and assistance. Lost Lander composed, performed, and produced all of our original music. I'm Shanna Sheehy. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll see you next time.
The ideas, opinions, and commentary you hear on Kids These Days are those of the hosts, guests, and contributors, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of its funders or broadcast partners. The Content Producers Guild is solely responsible for what you hear on the program. Kids These Days is made possible by a generous grant from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Kids These Days is produced in partnership with KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage, KRUA, and the UAA Department of Journalism and Public Communications.